Production support for Earth Eats comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. On today's show, we take a look back at a couple of stories on creative strategies for providing food assistance. Harvest Public Media has a story on tariffs and farmers. And Jackie B. Howard shares a recipe with winter squash and Brussels sprouts. That's all just ahead, so stay tuned. All you hear about in the U.S. and China trade war is that it's bad for manufacturing and farmers. But farmers are mostly collateral damage in this international struggle over power and technology. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck explains why.
Intellectual property theft costs the U.S. at least $225 billion a year, according to the National Bureau of Asian Research. And the country that does it the most is China. But that's nothing new. Or in other words,
this is not all about Trump.
That's Aaron Friedberg, a Princeton University professor who's been watching U.S.-China trade relations for about 20 years.
He is reacting to complaints and pressures that have been building up for over a decade.
Friedberg says China's government has abused U.S. markets and trade a lot of different ways over the last few decades. But generally what happens is that government incentivizes its companies to acquire and improve technologies from foreign competition. Sometimes Chinese companies get that technology in illegal ways, like through cyber attacks and outright stealing of robot arms. Friedberg says that a few decades ago, China's infractions weren't as big of a deal.
If you go back to the 90s and even into the early 2000s, Chinese industries were lagging considerably behind their Western counterparts. And so if they were cutting corners and doing things to promote the development of less advanced industries, I think the feeling was that this didn't matter so much.
But that's changed. The U.S. still leads the world in high-tech production, but China is a close number two and aims to grow. That's according to the U.S. Trade Representative Office, which advises the president on trade. The Chinese government has signed agreements to stop some of its illegal or unfair practices over the years, but a U.S. investigation in 2017 found that these things are still happening, like verbal backroom agreements that aren't on paper. So Friedberg says,
even when the Chinese haven't broken the rules, they've sort of bent them.
Previous administrations knew this was a problem and tried to pressure China. Friedberg says their actions didn't go far enough to stop China's bad actions at that time. But Ron Kirk was the U.S. trade representative for 4 years under President Barack Obama and stands by his work. He says they addressed American concerns by suing China multiple times through the World Trade Organization.
The one thing Americans were most frustrated about, they felt nobody ever held these people that weren't playing by the rules, our partners that weren't playing by the rules, feet to the fire.
But both he and Friedberg agree that Trump's approach to tackling this issue could be more effective if we worked with allies. Allies like Canada, which the Trump administration has put steel tariffs on. Right now, the U.S. is largely taking on China alone. China has fought back by putting tariffs on Trump's political base, part of which is farmers in rural America. Farm groups across the U.S. have voiced concerns and encouraged the president to find at least some short-term relief for trade. But at the same time, David Salmonson of the American Farm Bureau says they don't expect an overall trade agreement right away.
We know this has to be a longer-term process.
Ag hasn't been spared when it comes to intellectual property theft, though. One Chinese national was convicted of stealing corn seeds to send back to China for analysis. Plus, China has indicated it wants to grow and become a major competitor in the ag tech sector. So Salmonson says that ag isn't an island when you look at the big picture.
Since we're all a part of this relationship, yeah, it does. It affects everybody.
Some are concerned that the president may declare complete victory too soon after getting concessions over agriculture, that he'll walk away without significantly changing China's actions. If this happens, or trade negotiations go south, China's growing dominance in the world economy could create divisions in world trade. That wouldn't be the end of the world. Trade would just look more like it did during major wars, as different countries traded in blocks. But it could mean everyday goods become more expensive in the U.S., a nation full of companies that depend on the international economy. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
That was the first in Harvest Public Media's three-part series exploring the nearly year-long trade war between the U.S. and China. To read more, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Our recipe today comes from Jackie B. Howard. Jackie works here at the station, but she's also an accomplished chef. You've probably heard her before on Earth Eats. These days, Jackie does a lot of planning ahead and meal prepping for the week. Today's recipe is a warm slaw featuring Brussels sprouts, roasted butternut squash, and spicy bratwurst. The butternut's been cubed, seasoned, and roasted. She's using it for some other dishes besides the slaw. The grilled brats were left over from a cookout and stashed in the freezer till she came up with an idea for them. Because that's how Jackie works. She uses what she has and preps one ingredient to use in several dishes. The butternut has cooled, the brats are thawed, and now she's getting the Brussels sprouts ready. She's cutting them in half and then using the slicer blade on her food processor.
Amazing how great those smell, just cutting them in half.
Right. I am a big fan of cabbage and you know, some people don't like Brussels sprouts, but I think they're so delicious. Just try them. Cut those in half and now we'll run them through the food processor. I'm putting together the slaw. I've got the Brussels sprouts through the processor, and I'm going to do a mustard vinaigrette. You can use any mustard.
I've done about 4 tablespoons.
Yeah,
five
I'm going to do 5, and I'm going to add vinegar and honey to it for now. I had the 5 tablespoons of mustard. We're going to do about 1 tablespoon of honey, and I just did about 1 tablespoon of red wine vinegar. And I want it to be slightly on the thicker side because the Brussels sprouts are going to give off a little bit of liquid when they cook. Plus, I'm adding oil. Pan is hot, and I'm going to do some olive oil on there. And so that's why I didn't put any olive oil into my dressing, because I'm putting it on the pan to saute my Brussels sprouts. If I were going to do that as a dressing for, if we were going to do the Brussels sprouts cold as a cold salad, I would put the olive oil into my vinaigrette. So Brussels sprouts are going into the pan. I'm going to throw about 1 teaspoon of salt. And I'm going to do cracked black pepper for this. 6 to 8 cranks. The Brussels sprouts smell delicious. They smell warm. It has that, like, it fills your senses. It's not bright like basil. That's going to smell really bright and fresh, and the Brussels sprouts smell warm and toasty. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to saute them up too much because I want to still keep this fresh and hearty and keep some texture to it.
You want a little bit of crunch in there.
Yes. So this has just been, I don't know, like a minute probably, 2 tops. I'm going to add my dressing, that mustard dressing. I'm going to toss that around. And now that this is getting wet, I don't want to cook it much more because that wet dressing is going to pull out more moisture from my Brussels sprouts. So I'm actually turning the heat off now. And I'm going to add my brats. And I'm going to add the red onion. I didn't saute the red onion with the Brussels sprouts because I want the red onion to get warm and break down just a little bit, but I want to keep it kind of fresh and bright, and that's what's going to help it taste more fresh when I eat it later. I'm going to taste it as it is now before I add my butternut squash. Once I put that butternut squash in, it's soft. I don't want to mix it much more after that. So I'm going to taste it now. Then I will put in the cherries and the butternut squash, give it a light toss, and then it can be put into containers for the week. So even just being there for like 30 seconds, the brats already have their flavor on the Brussels sprouts as well. Those extra seasonings really complement the mustard, and that mustard is not nearly as tangy now.
Jackie decided to add a little bit more vinegar to balance out the sweetness of the butternut and to cut the fattiness of the brats.
I'm gonna taste it again. Yeah, that's what I like. I like it tangy. If you taste it and it tasted fine, don't add extra vinegar to it. But I like it that little tangy. So I'm gonna get the butternut squash. About a cup or so into this slaw mix. Stir that around.
They're holding their shape pretty good though.
They are, which is really nice. And that's what's so crucial about letting them cool before adding them to this, is it does help them retain their shape once you add them. But now I'm adding it to something warm, so it's going to start to break down the more I mix it.
The last thing to go into this warm slaw is the fresh pitted sweet cherries. Then it's time to taste.
So I've got to get something of everything in every bite. The Brussels sprouts are cooked perfectly. Like, they're just not soggy or anything. They're nice and crisp, but they're not raw. It's just right. Yeah. It's got a really nice crunch to it. Yeah, that's going to be a satisfying dinner.
It's, like I said, it's filling, but light.
Jackie will package this up into meal-sized containers to enjoy throughout the week. Find more recipes from Jackie Howard on our website, eartheats.org. And look for more from Jackie in the coming weeks here on Earth Eats. You might want to go ahead and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And of course, on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers. Featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. I heard a story on NPR a while back about venison, also known as wild deer meat. The story talked about how it's illegal to sell deer meat unless it's been raised on a farm. So if you're a hunter and you end up with more deer meat than your family can use in a season, you can't sell it. However, you can give venison away, and you can share it with a food pantry or a soup kitchen if it's processed in a commercial facility. The processing can be expensive, though. And that's where an organization called Hoosiers Feeding the Hungry comes in. They raise funds to help offset the cost of processing so that farmers and hunters with meat to donate don't have to foot the bill for processing. They can also step in when wildlife management implements a deer cull. Last winter, the city of Bloomington conducted a deer herd reduction at the Griffey Lake Nature Preserve. The cull was an attempt to manage the deer population and reduce damage to many plant species in the nature preserve. The issue was highly controversial in the community, but it felt like a silver lining to learn that the venison was being processed locally and donated to the Hoosier Hills Food Bank. I stopped into Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, a food pantry served by the Hoosier Hills Food Bank, to see how folks responded to venison as an option. A guy named Homer was running the meat counter.
What have you got in the meat counter today?
Oh, it's kind of a limited selection today. We have smoked sliced turkey. We have ground venison and ground beef.
People excited about the venison?
They are. It's gone very quickly. We'd like to encourage all the deer hunters in this part of the country to remember us when they harvest their deer.
So are you a hunter yourself?
Not anymore. I used to when I was feeding all my kids. We had big gardens, and I'd put a deer in the freezer every year, and we'd kill a couple of pigs, but it's just me and my wife now. So I still went, I'd take off and go to the woods, but I wouldn't kill anything. Finally, she says, you know, you don't have to carry the gun. She said, you want to go out in the woods and sit, just go out there and sit. So,
if you were going to cook with it, what would you make?
Well, till my kids grew up and left home, they didn't know it wasn't hamburger. And we made everything with it. We made chili, spaghetti sauce, pizzas, and obviously burgers, meatloaf, anything you could use ground, any kind of ground meat for, you can use ground venison for.
I talked with John All, who was getting plastic bags ready for people at the front desk.
Yeah, we got probably, I don't know, 100, 150 pounds of venison in and bagged up. And it's about all gone now. That was about 2 or 3 hours ago.
So people are excited to get it?
Oh, yeah. Most of them are. A lot of them don't, you know, because it's got a different taste. They're kind of back away from it. Most people like it. And it's nice, big sizes for families, too.
Yeah, it's more than a pound.
Oh, yeah. It's about 3 or 4 pounds.
Oh, that's great. Do you like deer meat?
Oh, yeah. I eat it every chance I get. Every time we have it here, I'm on it. Well, you can cook up a big hamburger and it stays that way. It don't shrink up like hamburger meat does, you know. It actually stays that size, whatever you make it, because it hasn't got much fat, you know.
But it's still got a good flavor and everything?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I like it.
Before I left the pantry, the venison was gone. There's a national organization called Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry, or FHFH. There might even be a chapter in your area. We'll have a link on our website to help you find out. EarthEats.org. Most people don't think of deer hunting as a source for emergency food providers. With an imperfect food system, people have to get creative to find ways of getting fresh, local, nutritious food to families who need it. And that's the mission behind Farm to Family Fund.
My name's Janice Lilly. I'm Deborah Piston-Hatlin, and our organization is Farm to Family Fund. So this is where we buy up produce at the end of the market for half price from the farmers who have extra and would like to sell to us. And then we deliver it directly to the Rise, the community kitchen, and Mother Hubbard's cupboard.
I went around the market with Deborah one Saturday as she asked farmers if they would have anything to donate at the end of the market.
Hi, Kim. Are you going to have anything today?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Bit.
We haven't had anything since December 9th, so that'll be great. We'll be back.
Okay.
Hi there.
Hi there.
You got anything for us today?
I think that I do, yes. Well, thank you very much.
We'll be back to pick it up.
Cool.
It's not really a donation, though. The farmers do get paid for the food that Farm to Family picks up when the market's over. It's just half price instead of full price. She gives everyone a sheet to keep track of how much they have to share, to make sure everyone gets paid the right amount.
I'm Teresa Bertles, and I own Heartland Family Farm.
And so what kinds of things have you been able to offer for the Farm to Family Fund in the past?
We do, in the early season, quite a bit of greens. If we have leftover greens as the season goes on, we do potatoes, sweet potatoes, and winter squash. We've also gone through the Farm to Family Fund with some chickens, and that was a real winner. People really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I bet. I think when people think of something like this, they wouldn't normally think that meat would be a part of it.
Right, and meat is often a high dollar item for families to purchase, so to have the opportunity to have organic or free range chicken is a wonderful thing.
I asked for her thoughts on the Farm to Family Fund.
My perspective is it is both honoring to the farmer for the work of the farmer's hands and also honoring to the people who need the food. And so it's a win-win situation. And, you know, often when people think about, well, you have these things left over, why don't you just donate them? And we do. lots of times we do, and that's wonderful. But the Farm to Family Fund is honoring the work that we do. You know, when you're out there working hard and you have things left over, yes, you might be eating a lot of kale that week or feeding it to livestock or chickens, but it's much better to get even just half the price of it and know that it's going to nourish your community.
After they gather up the food from the farmers and collect the paperwork, we head out to Janice's car. She and her husband Carrie have loaded up the back of their Prius with produce, and Deborah and her husband have the rest in their car.
Okay, we're good. We're coming.
I ride with Janice and Carrie.
Bye.
So what's our first stop today?
The first stop is at the Rise. The Rise is the apartment building that is part of Middleway House, which is a program for families escaping domestic abuse. So we always go to the Rise first, but we leave them like, you know, maybe half a dozen heads of lettuce and three or four butternut squash. Sometimes we'll get a half bushel bag of apples in the early part of the season, and they love getting those. So a few small things like that. And then we go to the community kitchen and basically open the car and say, this is what we've got this week, what do you want? And then everything else that we have left, we take to the hub.
We pull up at the Rise and a staff member buzzes us in.
Okay, so we have some microgreens. And we have some basil, butternuts, and lettuce. Can we put this out?
Then it was back to the car and on to the next location.
The next stop is the community kitchen of Monroe County. And they make meals for people in the community who don't have access to food. So when we get there, they're in the process of cooking their dinner. And so they'll look at what we have and they'll take things that they'll put in their cooler. And sometimes they'll take things and use them for dinner that night.
Heather Craig is a cook and volunteer coordinator at the community kitchen. She met us at the back door to the kitchen.
A lot of butternuts.
Sweet. I have a really large group of volunteers coming back this afternoon and I need stuff for them to do so they can peel butternut squash and chop. They're a great group. Yes, we will take all those.
Okay. And then other than that, we have some basil.
Ooh, I get so excited.
Microgreens.
I love them, but nobody else uses them. I'll throw them in the salad tonight.
That's what we said.
There we go. Yeah, I'm like the one who likes to use all the fun stuff. See, maybe Alex would like some. He's making a frittata for the vegetarian, so maybe some basil. Oh, here, I can count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, it looks like. 15 squash.
And a basil.
So, yeah, we look very much forward to all this fresh.
Baby beans.
Actually, I think, let me save some for the hub. Let me just take two.
Okay.
So somebody else. Oh, here, you can have that bag and I'll put that, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
work.
I took two.
So what do you think you're going to do with that basil?
Well, I said Alex is making, he's cooking today. I'm volunteer coordinating, so he's going to make a frittata. So I think he's going to probably put some fresh basil in there with some vegetables and make a nice, that'll be a wonderful addition.
What do you think will happen with all that butternut?
Well, I think Monday we have some beef stew meat thawed out, and I just had the volunteers peel up and cut up a bunch of potatoes, so I'll have that. We'll have a nice root vegetable beef stew, which sounds pretty darn good, especially if it stays like this weather.
The cooks at the community kitchen focus on healthy meals and they want them to be delicious. They incorporate fresh local ingredients any chance they get.
So our last stop is Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, which is also known as the Hub, and they are a food pantry. They also have an extensive education program teaching people about nutrition, how to cook food, how to grow food, how to preserve food.
So, and what's the situation here? Does somebody meet you here, or?
We have a key. They trusted us with the key.
Okay.
Janice and Carrie, Deborah and Merrill,
carry the last of the bins full of produce up the steps and into the hub, which is closed on Saturdays. They head straight for the walk-in cooler in the back storage area. Even after the rise in the community kitchen took what they could use, there's still plenty left for the hub.
Greens, including microgreens. We've got a big bag of garlic. We've got Jerusalem artichokes. And we have a good selection of microgreens also.
Having worked at the hub myself, I know firsthand what a welcome sight those fresh local foods will be when the staff and volunteers set up the pantry on Monday morning, especially now in the middle of winter. I asked Janice and Deborah if this was a typical amount for a Saturday in February.
We've had some weeks when we have spent up to probably $2,500 in one week, and that's at half price. So we're buying $4,500 to $5,000 of food at our max times, but we haven't had many of those.
And then this year has been particularly bad?
This year has been particularly bad. Through January and into February, we've been buying a couple $100 a week.
And what is the explanation of that from the farmers?
Well, it was really cold. You know, we had that really cold spell, and then also it was dark. So the greens especially kind of suffered during that period and then had a hard time, just slow coming back. And you can tell, we can tell today how much more there is. So you can tell it's starting to warm up. Mm-hmm. And days are getting longer.
Yes. Days are getting longer. A little more light, a little bit more.
As the days lengthen and the temperatures rise, farmers will have more excess produce to share, and Farm to Family Fund will have the funds available to compensate farmers. If you want to learn more about the Farm to Family Fund, the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market, or any of the organizations in this story, just visit our website at eartheats.org. A big thank you to the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Renee Reed, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Homer Kinder, John All, Janice Lilly, Deborah Piston Hatlin, Jackie B. Howard, and everyone at the Hub and the Community Kitchen. Our theme music was composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats this week. We'll see you next time. Production support comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers, offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.